Hello and welcome to the Mentalese Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mentalese and author of RFARL's weekly newsletter, Central Asia in Focus. An appalling video from Uzbekistan of a groom hitting his new bride at their wedding reception has made the rounds on social networks, sparking outrage. But violence and discrimination against women are happening in other Central Asian countries, and the problem seems to be getting worse in recent years. A member of the Kyrgyz parliament proposed banning young women from traveling alone outside the country unless they had permission from their parents or husbands. In Turkmenistan, there are new unwritten rules governing women's appearance, and women are suddenly banned from sitting in the front seat of cars. What is happening in Central Asia right now, and why this hostile attitude toward women in recent days and months? To discuss all this, I am joined by Aina Bhatia Alimova, founder and executive director of Progress Foundation, which works to support various progressive educational initiatives that benefit the public in Turkmenistan, such as the soglik.org website, which has been working to improve public health literacy in Turkmenistan over the last 11 years, including becoming a leading source of COVID-19 information in the Turkmen language. Laila Nazbul Said Beck, a lawyer living in exile in Europe. Laila is the chairwoman of the NGO Freedom for Eurasia and a member of the working group for the Global Treaty to End All Forms of Violence Against Women and Girls. Nigina Huralova, an adjunct professor at Webster University in Tashkent, and she teaches political science and sociology-related classes. She is also a master's student at the University of Glasgow in Eurasian Studies. Her research interests focus on gender, Islam, and education in Central Asia, with a special focus on Uzbekistan. Thank you all for joining me today. The video of the groom striking his bride on what should have been one of the happiest days of their lives is disturbing enough, but as shocking was the reaction, or better put, the lack of reaction from any of the other people in the room. Is violence and discrimination against women getting worse in Central Asia? Laila, I'm going to start with you, please.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me and providing this great platform to bring up the issue of violence against women and girls in Central Asia and globally. Yes, the tradition of violence, the culture of violence in Central Asia is on the rise currently, unfortunately, and we can see it from the cases that are coming out that we are being informed about. And it might also be partially due to a COVID pandemic because the victims, the women, have been locked in their homes with the perpetrators, with their abusers. This COVID pandemic has really drew attention to the issue of abuse and violence against women.
Thank you very much. And Nigina Han, you actually just wrote an article about this, didn't you?
Together with Svetlana Zardanova, we worked on two projects recently that examines the violence against women in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan particularly. And what we have found is indeed, yes, COVID-related restrictions, stay-at-home orders, loss of jobs and income exacerbated the existing patterns of gender-based violence in Central Asia. This can be seen probably in numbers, of course, right? Uzbekistan, for example, introduced the protection orders for women who faced violence in 2020. In 2020, they officially registered over 14,000 cases of violence, most of them being psychological and physical violence. But in 2020, the number reached almost 40,000 cases. And at the same time, we also observed the increase of suicide among women during the pandemic in Uzbekistan. In 2020, 900 women committed suicide, but before that, annually the number used to be 600 only. And the Ministry of Internal Affairs explained it due to the conflicts between wife and husband or between wife and mother-in-laws, which already shows that the prevalence of domestic violence to be more.
And about, I'm going to get to you in a second, but I just want to ask something about this. You know, when we saw this video, you know, it was like I mentioned the lack of reaction, the fact that this groom could hit his bride in front of everyone and no one stepped in, you know, and said that. And of course, this is just something that actually got caught on video. We have no idea how bad this situation is when there's not a camera around or anything. But what is it about the society that makes some people, well, makes people not want to step in? Why doesn't somebody object to this? Do you have any idea why this seems to be acceptable? Is not the word, but anyway, it's one of those things where people seem to look at it and go, it happens. What can you do? What is that the mentality, and why is that so?
Yes, unfortunately, it is. People tend to perceive domestic violence as a family issue. Until the government change in 2016, domestic violence, the word was not even like, the notion itself was not even discussed openly anywhere. So it's something new that we have been addressing too, but it doesn't mean that it didn't exist. It has always been there. It's just new, maybe technology is allowing it more and more to be visible. And also the political will also is allowing, but the nature of the public perception is still most of the time is domestic violence is a family matter. Even among women themselves who face, who are subject to violence, think of the same. For example, Oydan Nur conducted a recent survey in Bukhara and found out that 56% of the participants, including 86% of women, say that the conflicts between husband and men is a family matter. It's not something that you would tell to others, or others would interfere, or you report to the police, etc.
You know, and I want to come back to this topic in just a second, but I want to bring Aina Bhatt in here also. Turkmenistan, of course, recently, since Serdar Berdimuhamedov came to power in March, they have a number of, like I said, unwritten rules all of a sudden that dictate how a woman should dress, what beauty care products she can and actually can't use at all. It just goes on and on. At the same time, this is a government that will tell you that it's, supports gender equality. Any idea what is the driving force behind the change in rules in Turkmenistan, and how are women reacting to that?
Thank you so much, Bruce, for inviting me to be part of this discussion. Yes, there is a wave of negative publicity around this news, developments in Turkmenistan. It's very hard to get two Turkmens to constructively discuss this news because we've been operating in this space where, due to the state of media in Turkmenistan, in this space where there's nothing is true and everything is possible type of situation, where, as you noted, this decree on restricting the beauty services, it's an unwritten decree, unwritten order. We know that it's applied arbitrarily. Its implementation varies from city to city, from one locality to another locality. Another thing that we do know, and this is not a speculation, that beauty salons in Turkmenistan are run and managed mostly by women and girls. So this is directly, these restrictions, these bans directly impact their livelihood. And another thing that we do know that is government is not addressing this wave of negative publicity that is really hurting the public and, of course, the government. To your question, why, what are women and girls are saying in Turkmenistan? So as you may know, there's no data on this issue. The government doesn't report any data. So we have to operate with data that international community provides. And just to add that, for example, according to UNICEF's mix, 59% of women in Turkmenistan think that their husbands have a right to hit them. That's the data that UNICEF provides. Another issue is that there's no language to talk about violence in general in Turkmen society, in particularly domestic violence, meaning there's no Turkmen language, constructive Turkmen language to engage around this topic. And Nigina noted this, and I agree with her that online the culture is changing. So this allows the topic to appear to turn from family issue into a public issue. So it's not a family matter anymore.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to dig a little bit more into this too. Of course, you know, all these countries are coming out of a Soviet heritage, where there was promoted some form of gender equality. As I had mentioned to a couple of you when we were talking privately, when I was there 30 years ago, it actually seemed like gender equality was at a much higher level than it is today. And so I'm really curious about what, obviously there's been a change in men in Central Asia. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that. What is it about men now that are they afraid of independent women? Are they afraid of the images they see of educated Western women or women outside the country or something? What's the driver for this that we all of a sudden they think that they have to put new rules on people? Or, you know, again, in the case that all of a sudden violence, public violence against women in a lot of cases is something they don't fear any repercussions from this. Lila, could you speak about that?
Yes, it's an interesting point. To some extent, yes, in Soviet Union, women had more rights or more freedom, I would say. And that would include, of course, the obligatory schooling, the obligatory job after the school, and you know, the authorities, of course, made sure that all these women have a job, and they're, you know, producing some sort of a product for the glory of the regime, right? And they are making their contributions regularly. The thing is, though, during Soviet Union, the women were not only used as workforce, which obviously after the Second World War was a big contribution, and the female workforce was a big portion of that, because there weren't that many left, men left after the war. The domestic work still remained the obligation of the woman, so she would have to do her job during the workday, return home and take care of the family and run the household and cook and clean and make sure the kids are fed and make sure the kids, you know, have done their homework and make sure the husband is fed and taken care of. So all of those additional liabilities were still with the woman, and men during Soviet Union didn't run the household. That was not a normal tradition to share these obligations and liabilities at home. So in a way, yes, it was different. And then after the collapse of Soviet Union, of course, women became the driving force during the 1990s and 2000, for example, in Kyrgyzstan. They became the driving force of the free economy. The Dordoy business can serve as a really good example where women took the initiative and basically were running an international trade route right there. So that has really drastically changed. And I forgot what was the second part of the question. I'm sorry.
I'm just curious, you know, and I want everyone to answer this too, but are men afraid of liberated women?
Yes, they are now very afraid of women being free. And in fact, I can say, for example, this effort to ban girls in Kyrgyzstan, 18, 20-year-old girls to leave Kyrgyzstan if they wish alone, without a husband or a father, is actually a way to control females, to control young females in Kyrgyzstan, and to make sure that they don't have access to additional resources such as additional education and so on. For example, you know, they didn't even try to make it appear as you know, as initiative that would treat genders equally. Like, they didn't propose to do the ban, the similar ban against boys of the same age, for example, you know. And how the authorities were saying, well, we don't want to let the girls go because we are afraid that they would engage in prostitution and they would, you know, start drinking, get bad habits, they would learn to drink alcohol and so on, and they would start meeting men. They could have said the same thing regarding boys, for example. They could join some terrorist organizations, which is, you know, a traditional accusation in certain countries in Central Asia, for example, against men, against opposition men. But they didn't even try to do that. They didn't even try to limit boys in that regard. It's quite clear that this is a way for men in Kyrgyzstan in particular to control a half of the society and take away their right to use the right of movement, basically, and decide their future.
Yeah, let me throw in another question here real quick, you know, because the author of this proposal, Shailu Bekatazov, right, he actually appeared when there was a demonstration just a couple of days ago in Bishkek, of women that were protesting his proposal, and he came out and he brought his own supporters and threatened them. But they on Twitter, for instance, I kept seeing people saying, "Well, he's a populist." Is that a populist view, really?
I see it a bit differently, I guess. He came out and he brought these women with him, and older women in Elicheks and these, hats, the Kyrgyz traditional hats. They normally sort of like represent a wise older woman in a Kyrgyz family traditionally. And so he brought these women with him who were basically preaching that girls should submit to the control of men that want to take away their right of movement, and actually, which leads to a loss of a number of other rights, such as access to education overseas, for example, as well. And unfortunately, we do see that older women participate in perpetuating such behaviors in the society, including continuous violence against women and girls.
Yeah, and I want to get to this too about the role of women in this discrimination also. But first, Nagina, do you see some men as being afraid of a liberated woman?
Yes, of course, but there are, I guess, other tools as well. In a sense, for example, I observe Islam has been resurging right since independence, and it's also being used to further limit women's rights, not because like Islam stands against women, but its interpretation is too strict sometimes, and it's used not only by men but women as well. There are many cases that women like religious figures, for example, are approaches whether online or in the ceremonies, right, saying that my mother-in-law is asking my husband to divorce me because she is not satisfied with my service. Although, like Islam says, do not have any obligation to serve mothers-in-law, the elderly women kind of uses it as a tool, like, I'm not liking your wife, you either divorce her or I will disown you, like in terms of Islam. So this is one side. I also observe here the aspect of media as well, which is different both like from the Soviet times and in compared to other countries probably, because especially entertainment such as movies and TV shows, right? There are many movies that would depict how cruel mothers-in-laws are and how young women are always depicted as obeying, patient, always cleaning and cooking, not leaving their husbands even if they beat or cheat on them, married the second wife, etc., etc. And from one side, this is a reflection of the reality, of course, but from the other side, it further perpetuates the violence against women among women themselves, because elderly women watching those TV shows or TV series or different talk shows where they compete women against each other, like who is a better killing, let's check it, right? And they would think like, okay, everyone is acting like this, I also should behave like this, like I should torture my killing, she should know her place, and this cycle goes on.
Aina Bhatt, I'm curious, too, we were talking about media, but let's talk about social media a little bit, too. Now, we know in Turkmenistan that social media is closely monitored by the security service, but yet apparently there's misogynist comments circulating on social networks at the moment in Turkmenistan that are surely being seen. And if they were calls for overthrowing the government, the police and security services will be out immediately and tracking these people down. But my understanding is that these messages that are very aggressive and against women are still circulating on social networks in Turkmenistan. Can you talk about that?
Yes, Bruce, that's right. There are several groups, and they do have increased increasing number of followers. They are pretty large groups. We're not talking about individuals. These are, some of them are, yeah, quite have a large number of followers. So it seems to me that the discussions in those groups, and they're open groups, public can access them, where they post a lot of content content that promotes misogyny, where very limited role of women are promoted, where she's only seen as a bride, as a sister, or just a wife. So there are a lot of groups like that. Not a lot, but there are some groups like that, and nothing is changing in terms of no one is communicating with them. They're definitely not engaging with us, within our project. It looks like nobody is communicating with them to, you know, remove or to limit this type of content. Going back to your question on men's reaction. So in the context of Turkmenistan, I would like to just share my observations. Men in Turkmenistan, first of all, not all men are afraid of independent women. I know we're having a lot of men listeners right now. I just want to make it clear that we're not talking about all men. So we have allies, and we're always looking for allies. So why are they not publicly speaking up? It's a great question that I ask my colleagues. I keep asking our readers. One of the things that we see is that there are no incentives for them to speak up online. And this doesn't depend, this has nothing to do with it. It seems to me that it has nothing to do with their educational level, because there are also young men and boys who go and study outside of the country, and they come back and they have difficulties with, you know, surviving in the culture that promotes specific social and cultural norms, right? So they have no support. There is no genuine attempt to include them into conversations on gender equality, for example. There are very few voices, but they're out there. They need support, because there's this understanding that what will other men will say, right? If I speak up, what will other men say about this, right? The reputational risk, that they're afraid of that. And another thing is that, for example, I can see that this conversation is happening in limited spaces about men reflecting on how they grew up in abusive families in Turkmenistan, right? What their fathers did to their mothers and towards their sisters. And the understanding is that I would like to be different. But again, since they do not have support in terms of, you know, resources, creating projects, programs, communicating it to the public, it's just, you know, we still have a large groups of men due to education, due to many other factors, choosing violence because it's a very easy tool. You know, it's very hard, you know, as we all know, it's hard to change the behavior, cultural norms. But violence, it seems to me, as a default right now, is a just very easy tool to deal with problems.
I also wanted to add an additional kind of comment in regards to our question on Soviet Union thing. You know, as the Soviet Union collapsed and this entire information out of the West went towards our countries, you know, people kind of saw what feminism is, right? I mean, they started getting information what the Western feminists are doing and what sort of freedoms the Western women have and so on. And I think a lot of men in our countries, they have obviously misunderstood what feminism is all about. And that image, that negative sort of image kind of stuck, it is still stuck there. And their understanding of Western women having so much freedom, and they're like, oh my God, you know, we can't have our women have the same amount of freedom. It's going to be horrible. Because, you know, if they have all these freedoms, and we have to share the other obligations with them, we're going to have to work also in the household. And that's not really what we want. So kind of sort of like this sort of thinking was still there. And then in regards to the free women, I have been kind of able to observe some of the behaviors of men in Central Asia. And what I feel is they're very afraid to have girls and women, especially young women, that understand and know what life has for them, what possibilities they have in the world, and that if they want it, they can have it. And they are very afraid that there will be a competition, that they would have to compete for these women. And if they know, if these women know that they have all these rights, all these freedoms, and they can choose for themselves without asking any man in their family, father, brother, husband, or anybody else They can make these decisions for themselves. And this is a very, very scary situation for men in Central Asia. That is my feeling. And the obligation, and then they would have to, you know, start working on their relationships, that they have to invest time and effort and attention, and is a lot of work. The relationship is a lot of work, and that's something they really don't want to do. This current bride, for example, she's a very young girl. I think, as far as I know, she's only 20 years old. It's an age where she probably, so there is probably not much she knows about life outside of the family. And this is very convenient for men, where they know that she is completely dependent on them. They have full control over her, over her life, over her body. And she really has nothing to compare her groom with. And she doesn't have a job. She doesn't have education. He can treat her in whatever way he wants, because she won't walk away. She has no choice. She's going to stay with him. So that, and there was another thing, interesting thing that we have noticed under my tweet to that video. There were a lot of comments from men there that were saying, if it was my daughter, if it was my sister, that they would obviously punish the groom. And it's an interesting observation that when men were making comments like this, that so many men felt that they were talking about a woman as their property, as the entity that belongs to them. My sister, my daughter, my sister. So an entity that can't really decide for herself, that she needs a man to be there to protect her, to help her, to make decisions for her and so on. So still, the reaction, obviously, the people were mad. Men were mad when they saw this act of abuse. And they still yet kind of thought about this woman as you know, their property, as someone who can't really make these decisions or defend herself on her own.
It's an interesting observation. I agree. I hadn't thought about that, but it's not like as just an objective outsider that saw something like this, they wanted to intervene, but they looked at them. They mentioned that it would, if it was their sister or somebody who had a personal connection to them, then they would be willing to.
Right. I mean, a woman is still kind of, she is within the realm of the family. She always belongs to somebody. It's either the father, the brother, or the husband. She can't be by herself and not belonging to anyone. That's kind of unthinkable, right? That you can be actually your own and nobody else's.
This is, again, the RFARL's Majlis podcast, a weekly podcast that looks at affairs in Central Asia. This week, our topic of our conversation is gender violence and discrimination against women in Central Asia, a problem that seems to be getting worse. Today, I am joined in the studio by Laila Nazgul Saidbek, a lawyer living in exile in Europe and originally from Kyrgyzstan. And she is working with NGO Freedom for Eurasia and is also a member of a working group for a global treaty to end all forms of violence against women and girls. Nigihan Oralova, an adjunct professor at Webster University in Tashkent, who teaches political science and sociology-related classes. She is also a master's student at the University of Glasgow in Eurasian Studies. Her research interests focus on gender, Islam, and education in Central Asia, with a special focus on Uzbekistan. And Aynabat Yailimova, founder and executive director of Progress Foundation, which works to support various progressive educational initiatives that benefit the public in Turkmenistan, including Soglik.org, which has been working to improve public health literacy in Turkmenistan over the last 11 years, including becoming a leading source of COVID-19 information in the Turkmen language. I'm Bruce Benair, the host of the Mejlis podcast and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. And we are, again, discussing gender violence and discrimination against women. Thank you, guests. You know, I want to move, we've talked, mentioned this a little bit in the first section of this broadcast, but a lot of the violence and discrimination against women seems to be promoted by older women who have undergone this same process, but yet perpetuated at the same time. I'm thinking, for instance, of Ala Kachu in Kyrgyzstan, where, you know, when a young girl is kidnapped and brought to this house, it's older women who come out and try to put the white scarf on her head, signifying that she's just become the property of that family. They themselves might have been married under similar circumstances and should remember how horrible that was. You know, and it's also the mother-in-law that we hear about so often in Central Asia, one of the most feared figures for any young woman who's about to get married, that mother-in-laws basically put them in a state of slavery. They also physically abuse them sometimes. And yet, at the same time, there are members of the government who are women, right? And there's committees, commissions, all kinds of different organizations within the government that are supposed to promote gender equality, equal rights. Certainly, every time there's foreign guests from representatives from the United Nations, for instance, OSCE, anything like that, this is one of those things that everyone says, yes, we're for gender rights, equal rights. But yet at the same time, you know, how much do women actually perpetuate some of these discriminatory practices in society? Nagina?
I guess there is a role of women also who would continue, like perpetuate this violence, yes. But what I observe is it's not because they want something evil to the young women, but because that's the only way they are familiar with for women to survive, to have a decent life. We're talking about women in Central Asia, like where they have almost no decision in their lives until they are more or less elderly, right? Whether it's about education or traveling somewhere or attending or working, et cetera, et cetera. Those major decisions of life are usually decided by their parents. Even in terms of marriage, yes, there is less and less forced marriage in Uzbekistan, of course, but it's always arranged marriage. So it's usually the two parents find themselves and like allow their sons and daughters go on a date, and the girl should decide with two or three daters, decide like if she is going to marry that boy or another boy, right? And after that, it's always husband who decides for her what to wear, where to go, what to do, etc., etc. And then finally, when they become mothers-in-law, that's the place where she can somehow exert some power towards the Achilleans. That's where that's one way for them to take out all their bitterness that they have had so far. That's one thing. Another thing is the status of married women, because elderly women, as they perceive it, the only like a good thing for a girl to happen is having a husband. That's why they are always, no, like, you are not divorcing. We are not taking you back. If your husband is beating, just have sabr. This phase will go away, but you will have a husband. It's good for your children. It's good for yourself. That, like, that's a good position. That's my observation so far.
Thank you. Aynabat, what's the situation in Turkmenistan?
Yes, so there are women who think that women are inferior, and the logic goes like this. So they think that they are following these traditions in the name of saving her honor, reputation, avre in Turkmen. And this has been done for many ages by our ancestors, Atavavalarmad. So, and we will continue doing this because it works. Definitely, they have not tried anything else. So, and they don't see anything else being tried and, you know, and shared in Turkmen culture. So they continue this a cycle of violence. And just to note that state media, you know, in its production of movies, perpetuates this violence, you know. And when we say violence, we don't, of course, only mean physical violence. It's verbal violence, emotional, psychological. So it's communicated, this inferior position of women and girls communicated through, you know, movies and this mother-in-law and daughter-in-law dynamics, you know, husband and wife, chores, you know, it is communicated the ideal of what good Turkmen wife should be. So it's very hard to stand up to this wave, of course.
And Lila, you know, the reason that I wanted to talk about this topic was specifically because former Kyrgyz president Roza Otunbayeva, and I want to emphasize at this moment that is the only woman who's not only been president of Kyrgyzstan, but she's the only woman that's been a president of any Central Asian country. But she said a couple years ago, when they brought up the topic of Alakachu, she was the one that said that you know, yes, definitely, you know, it's this strange tradition, and men bear the bulk of the responsibility for this, but that women also some women are involved in this also. And so I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, how that is in Kyrgyzstan, and how some women are reinforcing the very things that they undoubtedly didn't like when they were younger.
Oh, yes, definitely. I have a lot to say on this subject. I'll start with a story of how I was kidnapped when I was 16 years old. I just returned from a year as a Flex alumni in the United States. I was invited to a picnic by a friend of mine, a girl, and apparently that was a trick to get me into a car with young men whom I actually have never seen in my life. And so they bring me to the house of the groom-to-be, and I see women there. The house is full of older women, probably his sisters, aunties, grandmas, and so on. And so they place me in this room, and I'm sitting there thinking, what am I going to do, right? And I'm trying to speak with these women, and I'm like, I'm not going to marry. I have no plans to marry right now. You got to let me go. And they wouldn't listen to me. And so the only way I got out was because I actually got into a bad habit of smoking right around that time. So I started trying cigarettes. And I had one cigarette, a cigarette and a lighter in my purse that I left in the car when they dragged me into the house. So I asked one of the women if they can bring me the purse, and they gave me the purse. And I started smoking in that room. And so as soon as the people realized that the smell of smoke is coming out of the room, they opened the door. The door was locked. So they opened the door, and they're standing there looking at me with disdain, with such a disgust on their face. It was unbelievable. And I was like, wow, what a reaction. And so obviously at that time I was deemed unfit. I was not, you know, I was spoiled goods basically. And I was released. And what was amazing to me at that time, I thought, so, you know, smoking makes me a horrible person, you know, in the eyes of these people. But stealing my future, trying to, you know, planning to rape me tonight is actually an acceptable thing for them. That was a shocking discovery for me. And one of the things that my mother told me as I was growing up, I was probably a teenager at that time, and I still remember that, she said, please do not ever, make sure that you do not ever live with the family of your husband, whatever that family is, however nice they are, you have to make sure you live separately. And I think that was a really important advice. One of the things I also wanted to mention is the participation of women in the rape that follows the kidnapping. Now, all the women in the household know exactly what is going to happen at night. And none of them try to stop that. And in fact, all of them participate actively in stopping the girl from leaving. And so once the girl spends the night at the house of the groom, she can't really go back because people will think that she is no longer a virgin. And she, you know, nobody's going to want to marry her after that because she was, she had sex. She spent the night and she's no longer fit for a good marriage. And it was actually one of the cases I have interviewed was a girl who was being raped by her relatives throughout her teenage years by an uncle and a cousin. And her mother and her grandmother knew about this. And as she grew up, she was about in her 20s. Her grandmother actually set up a marriage for her with one of the distant relatives in the village and arranged for her to be kidnapped. And she refused to stay there. And when the grandmother came and tried to talk her into staying, the thing that grandmother said was probably the most painful, as this girl told me, was one of the most painful things she has ever heard in her entire life, because it was it was a betrayal. It was an act of betrayal. And the grandmother said, you're not a virgin anymore. We know that. You will never be able to marry to a good young man. So this is a good option for you. Why don't you just stay? We'll be married. You'll have kids. No, just stay. And she didn't. And she didn't. She went to Europe. She received education, and she's living the life that she wanted to live. But that's just one of thousands of examples. There was another recent example that actually was quite striking. I met a member of medical staff in the hospital just recently, a few days ago, and she turned out to be Moldovan. And she actually was very surprised to find out that I was from Kyrgyzstan. She was apparently, as an 18-year-old, she was married to a Kyrgyz man that was 40 years ago. And she told me a horrendous story of how she actually went to Kyrgyzstan with her young husband in hopes of building a family, and how she was abused and mistreated by his family members. And absolutely, it is true that in most of the cases, young brides and young wives that are coming to the family of their husbands are seen as domestic slaves, domestic servants. And they're doing very heavy domestic work without pay. They are denied education. And usually, quite often actually, are not even, you know, legally registered. This is not, these are often not legally registered marriages, which means she has absolutely no right to anything, no alimonies, no child support if she has children, which she usually does. And at any moment, she can be thrown out of the house and the husband can go and acquire a new one. And she will be left with nothing on the streets with kids.
Well, unfortunately, our time is running short. I knew that we could probably do this conversation for 4 or 5 hours, and that still wouldn't be.
That's true.
But what I want to do here is, you know, for the very last thing is to ask everybody if they one, if they have any advice for women out in Central Asia, but more specifically, if you know of any social networks, any organizations that can help people in these kind of situations, you know, that if you could talk about where people can find help or support, you know, where, including young women or women who are looking for legal support or something in your particular countries, or again, even on the internet or social networks. So we'll start with Nagina. Go ahead. Okay, that's fine.
Just really quickly, I wanted to recommend to visit a website of Every Woman Treaty. There is a huge work being done in regards to this issue. And it also contains a lot of resources, also including several very effective ways to tackle this problem, including the education of boys and men and girls and women about the situation, about the rights. There is tons of information on that website. So please do follow Every Woman Treaty on social networks and do visit the website. You can learn a lot from that.
Okay, great. Nagina?
I'm afraid, I'm sorry. I'm not sure how useful would be the information I'll provide about the places that women could go, because most victims of violence, especially the victims of physical violence, are from rural areas where they learn mostly about the world through TV. What we observe is what is needed in Uzbekistan is the social advertisements that would talk about the rehabilitation centers that has opened or the NGO shelters that operate, like there are a couple of them in Uzbekistan, actually, to advertise those help centers and other NGOs or government established rehabilitation and adaptation centers should be broadcasted on national television, because potential victims or like victims who are already being abused by their family members mostly watch TVs.
Right, thank you. Anabat?
So in our project at Saglik, we see domestic violence as a symptom of large structural issues, right? So just briefly, information that we provide, it directly relates to deteriorating educational and economic opportunities in Turkmenistan that result in poor health and educational outcomes in Turkmenistan, and also, deteriorating access to reproductive and sexual health, high child and maternal mortality rate, and also, I'm sure it's the same across Central Asia, it's absence of comprehensive sexuality education. So there's no magic solution to this problem, and we have to address so many, deconstruct it and address it at many levels with allies, with partners. So I would recommend listeners, Turkmen speakers, Russian speakers living in Turkmenistan or outside, to share their stories under our campaign that we're running. It's called Dymma, Ni Malchi in Russian, and Don't Be Silent. It means don't be silent in Turkmen, where we collect the stories and share them with public anonymously. I make it clear that it's anonymously shared. And we received so far about 20 stories, and we shared them on Saglik, and the reaction was amazing, overwhelming, meaning that many readers contacted us saying, we didn't know that. We knew that this problem existed in Turkey, for example, or in Russia, because we watch Russian movies and Turkish television, but we never thought that there was domestic violence, that there was abuse towards Turkmen women, girls in Turkmenistan. So please contact us on Instagram or via email, and let's have this type of conversation happening in Turkmen social media. Thank you.
And one more thing I'd like to add, if I can, maybe you can use it as well.
Please.
In our discussion, yeah, it's regarding Roza Otunbayeva that I forgot to mention. She is a unique example of women leadership in Central Asia. Obviously, of course, the thing is, she also became a victim of political violence against a female politician. There is actually such a term, and she has been attacked numerous times because she was a woman in politics. And she's not the only example of such political violence against female politicians. Clara Soronkulova also is being attacked because she is a woman in politics very often, also in discussions on social media. And when you kind of look at the dynamics in the internet, on social media, in regards to women in politics, you often see how certain representatives of authorities are using their gender, them being women, against them. Like, for example, these video clips that they have been making of Clara Soronkulova and a few other activists that were sitting in a cafe and drinking beer, I think it was. And they were like, oh, look, they're drinking beer. They're bad women. They're drinking beer. We don't want politicians like this in our politics. And we have seen also many comments such as, why are you even trying to participate in politics? You shouldn't be there. You should be a grandmother, a mother to your children. You should stay in the kitchen. So all of these, and that is not including actual efforts to open criminal cases against these women in politics, such as, for example, right now is happening, that they're trying to open a criminal case against Roza Otunbayeva, along with all the other parallel attacks that are happening against her.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that in. And actually, that's probably going to be one of the topics of an upcoming Bezley's podcast, is this recent campaign. But for now, I want to thank you all for joining me. And this is a tough conversation, but it was an important conversation, and I appreciate you being on the program today. So one more time, that's Nigina Han-Oralova, an adjunct professor at Webster University in Tashkent, who does research on that focuses on gender, Islam, and education in Central Asia, with a special focus on Uzbekistan. And Aina Bahati-Alimova, founder and executive director of Progress Foundation, which works to support various progressive educational initiatives that benefit the public in Turkmenistan. Laila Nazgul Saidbek, chairwoman of NGO Freedom for Eurasia and a member of the Working Group for the Global Treaty to End All Forms of Violence Against Women and Girls. Thank you all so much for being on the show. And a special thanks to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis producer in Washington. I'm Bruce Benair, once again, host of the Mejlis podcast and author of the Central Asian Focus newsletter. which you can subscribe to by visiting the RFARL website. That's rfarl.org. Thanks again, everybody, and we'll be back next week.